donate to this NPR station.
Good morning. Welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Lori. Well, coming up, we're going to talk with an historian who tells us how big taxes for the wealthy led to the Great Depression. And later, PolitiFact has named its lie of the year. We'll talk with a PolitiFact editor in a moment. And last night, Democrats won a seat in Alabama, a Senate seat in Alabama, surprising many observers. We're going to open up the phone lines to talk about that in a few minutes. But first, a listener comment about end times believers and President Trump's announcement last week about moving the U.S. Embassy in Israel from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. Here's what one listener had to say.
Thank you for your program today regarding Jerusalem Islam and also the one aired on December 6th. I have a peaceful resolution to the Israeli and Palestinian dilemma regarding Jerusalem as the capital of the State of Israel. I suggest to make Jerusalem just like the Vatican is in Italy, with its own laws, rules, and even stamps. The Vatican, in quotes, of Jerusalem will be ruled by all three secular religious leaders, Jewish, Christian, Muslim, holy leaders protected by the United Nations. Just like any other country, a visitor will need a visa to visit the holy sites. All profits to be shared equally, three ways to maintain Jerusalem, Vatican. I know this is too simple of a solution, but it is a peaceful one where everyone will be represented. Thank you, Rob, for all you do, and thank you for WMNF.
Well, that was a listener comment that came in after yesterday's program. The Republicans in Washington are making headway to come up with a final plan to cut taxes, the tax reform plan that they've been talking about since the beginning of the Trump administration. They plan to have the final plan ready this Friday, and then it could go to a vote next week. We heard there on the NPR News, a big question is whether or not the newly elected senator from Alabama will be admitted to the Senate in time for that vote. That's one of the big questions. We're going to talk with an historian right now who's an expert on the Great Depression. His name is Robert McElvain, and he teaches at Millsaps College in Mississippi. And his book about the Great Depression is The Great Depression, America, 1921 to 1941. He says that the current tax bill that's being debated and talked about in Congress could lead to another depression. And Robert McElvain, welcome to WMNF. Good to have you here.
Glad to be with you.
Why do you think the tax cuts that are being proposed in Washington, D.C. could lead to another Great Depression?
Well, I wouldn't necessarily go so far as to say another Great Depression, but certainly an economic collapse as we saw in 2008. The reason is that the Republicans continue to keep doing the same thing over and over again. This is referred to as the Trump tax cut, but that's completely misleading. Trump has no idea what's in it. He never does. It's basically the idea of trickle-down economics, which has been the Republican policy, tried and failed time and time again. We go back even before the 20s, go back to William Jennings Bryan giving his famous Cross of Gold speech in 1896, when he said, and I'm paraphrasing, that there are two types of political and economic thinking. One the Republicans follow is if you just make the people at the top very rich, their prosperity will leak through on those below them. But the Democratic idea is that if you legislate to make the people beneath prosperous, all those who ride on top of them will rise up from their prosperity. And that's been the case ever since. In the 1920s, the Republicans were in complete control of the government, as they are at the moment, and they were able to put their view of trickle-down economics into effect. This included three different tax cuts that greatly reduced what the people at the top were paying. It included, they didn't have a whole lot of regulation yet anyway, but reducing regulation and not putting any new regulation in. As Calvin Coolidge famously said, the business of America is business, and to just let business do what they wanted. It didn't work then. It has never worked. And I can go into some more details about why not, but that's kind of where we are.
Well, just getting back to William Jennings Bryan and the Cross of Gold speech, he was a Democrat, and he was already back then in the late 1800s fighting against trickle-down. You talked about the Republicans favoring trickle-down as far back as the 1890s?
Well, sure. It was the age of the robber barons, and they were on the side of concentrating as much wealth as possible at the top. You know, this has been the case pretty much throughout history in most places, that, you know, you had the nobility, the landed aristocracy, controlled most of the wealth. And while that might be morally questionable, and I would say it is, it wasn't necessarily disastrous for the economy, because the economies until you get into the 20th century were not based on mass production needing mass consumption. But by the time you get to the 1920s, much of the economy consists of stuff, goods coming off assembly lines in large quantities that have to be sold to large numbers of people. And if they don't get a big enough share of the income, they can't buy it and the economy doesn't work. And that's what was going on in the 20s. Productivity was going up. Wages actually went up. But the degree to which they were going up, if you think of it on a graph, the line was going up, but at a much lower angle than the line that was going up for corporate profits, dividends, and money going to the people at the top. And I think one of the most instructive things is that if you look at the concentration of income at the very top, and the very top, I'm talking about not the top 1%, not even the top 0.1%, but the 0.01%, peaked in 1928, between 6 and 7% of the entire income of the country were going to the top 0.01%. The next time that peaked at almost exactly the same level was in 2007, and the years 1929 and 2008 came following that, and I don't think that was just coincidental.
So in the 1920s, the Industrial Revolution had really sped up, and now people were moving from farms to factories, and how much regulation was there on the factories? Was there a minimum wage? Was there a 40-hour work week? Were unions easy to establish? Tell us about the situation in the 1920s.
Well, there were hardly any unions. They got weaker and weaker during the 1920s. Regulation was almost non-existent, and what there had been, the Republicans were trying to remove. Taxation was reduced greatly, and the idea that this is something that's been Republican dogma all along, Ronald Reagan famously said, I think it was during, while he was still campaigning, it may have been shortly after he became president, he said in the 1920s, Calvin Coolidge reduced taxes 3 times, and we had the greatest prosperity we've ever had. And he seemed to be unaware of the fact that that prosperity totally collapsed just after Coolidge left office, and those cuts in the taxes were a big reason for it. You could look particularly at the Revenue Act of 1926. The man who was behind these tax cuts was not really Coolidge, but the Secretary of the Treasury throughout the Harding Coolidge and most of the Hoover years, Andrew Mellon, who was one of the richest men in the world, and he was very much in favor of getting rid of all taxation possible on the very rich. And George Norris, who was a Republican progressive senator from Nebraska, said of this 1926 act that Mr. Mellon himself gets a bigger reduction in taxes than the aggregate of practically all the people in my state of Nebraska. And that was true. It's exactly the same thing now. This quote-unquote middle-class tax cut, which is not aimed at the middle class at all, will enormously benefit Mr. Trump himself, will, like Mr. Mellon, get a huge tax break. He Well, he is not exactly known for telling the truth. In fact, you can go back to 1980 when he was introducing the plans for Trump Tower, and he sent out the architect, and he said just at this press conference, just give them the old Trump BS, although he said the full word, and that's what he has been shoveling throughout his career. And so when he says, this is going to hurt me, my accountants will be so upset that we're passing something like this, and it's going to hurt all the rich people, that is entirely BS. Look, for instance, at the something that I don't think is getting nearly enough attention, repealing what remains of the estate tax. Republicans back, I don't know, 15 or 20 years ago, cleverly came up with calling it the death tax. Well, it's not a tax on the dead. We're all familiar with the saying, only two things are certain, death and taxes. But what is not pointed out is that they are mutually exclusive. The dead pay no taxes. It is their heirs who pay the taxes. And I've long argued it should instead be called the spoiled brat tax, or we could now call it the Don Jr., Ivanka, Eric, etc. tax. It is a tax on people who have done nothing to deserve the money other than pick rich parents. And it is also something, when it was set up in, I believe it was 1916 when they first set up the estate tax, one of the main purposes of it was to assure that we would not get a aristocracy, an hereditary aristocracy in the country, where people would simply be extremely rich from one generation to another, regardless of what they did to deserve it. And in that sense, trying to repeal this estate tax entirely might be seen as the tax to reverse part of the American Revolution, to set up an hereditary aristocracy in the country. It's absolutely disastrous. Let me just give one example. Again, Mr. Trump lies all the time. He also lies about how much he's worth. He's claimed to be worth $10 billion. He's certainly not worth that much. But if he were worth $10 billion, what the repeal of the estate tax would be worth to his heirs is $4 billion. And that tax applies only to the top 0.2% in the country. If you're in the 99.8% of people who are somewhat less wealthy, shall we say, the benefit you will get from the repeal of the estate tax is a nice round number, very round, zero. Nothing. And yet, hardly anybody's talking about that. That's about a third of the amount that's going to be added to the national debt, and it's going just to the fabulously wealthy people in the country, yet they call it a middle-class tax cut.
We're talking with Robert McElvain, who teaches at Millsaps College in Mississippi. He's the author of The Great Depression, America, 1921 to 1941. We're talking about an op-ed he wrote for the Washington Post just a few days ago called "I'm a Depression Historian. The GOP tax bill is straight out of 1929. And you're listening to WMNF in Tampa. Our phone number is 813-239-9663. When I think about the so-called death tax or the tax on estates, it is not a tax on the dead person. It's a tax on the income accruing to the kids of the person who died. It's income. It's a tax on the income, right?
Exactly. And, at some point in between when I suggested calling it the spoiled brat tax and now calling it the Don Jr., et cetera, tax, I suggested that you could call it the Paris Hilton tax. I mean, it's a tax not on people who did anything to earn the money whatsoever, except, again, have the wisdom to choose rich parents. And it goes totally against the idea of having a meritocracy of people should be rewarded on the basis of what they have accomplished themselves. And yet, you know, they're talking about a lot of other things, and there are all sorts of horrors in this bill. It's the worst piece of tax legislation in American history, as far as I can see. But not much is being said about the estate tax, and to me that's the most outrageous part of it all. But at the same time, they are attacking all sorts of other people. Some of the people behind this tax bill have openly said that they are using portions of it to attack their political enemies, the blue state people. We're going to get them because in those states of New York, California, Illinois, New Jersey, etc., they have high state and local taxes, which have always been deductible. Well, they're taking away the deductibility of that, and we're going to get back at them. Well, first of all, the reason that they have those high taxes in part is because they have to provide services to their people. Those are exactly the states that send much more to the federal government than they get back from the federal government. And yet some Republican senators are out there saying that, well, we're going to stop subsidizing these states. No, those are the states that are subsidizing states like Mississippi, where I live, that get back about $2 for every $1 we send to Washington. They're also attacking students and education in general, because, as one of the backers said the other day, most of those people on colleges are lefties, and so we're going to get back at them. It's just a total outrage.
Robert, going back to the 1920s, President Coolidge was elected, I believe, and you got to correct me, 1920, and remained in office for two terms until 28. The Wall Street crash happened on October of 1929. How did President Coolidge argue that now during the 1920s, during this rate of pretty good growth, that the wealthy and the rest of America deserved tax breaks? I mean, and going back, did I get that right? Did everybody get a tax break in the 1920s, or did it just accrue to the very wealthy?
Well, first of all, just a minor correction. He wasn't elected in 1920. Harding was, but he was Harding's vice president. And in 1923, when Harding died, he became president. The taxes, income taxes at the time, didn't really go down below like the upper middle class. So most people weren't paying any taxes at all, and they didn't have to get a tax break out of it. But again, arguing that this was in any way needed for the economy made no sense. Because, again, the problem is that people in a mass consumption economy have to have enough money to buy the things that are being produced. And that just wasn't the case because so much of it was going to the people at the top. They managed to stave off the collapse for a few years by letting people who didn't have the money buy automobiles and household appliances and so forth without the money, buy it on credit. But that simply made the collapse that much worse when it came, because people at that point not only didn't have any more credit to buy more things, but much of their current income was going to pay off past purchases, and so the collapse when it came was even worse.
This recovery has gone on since about 2009, or maybe a little bit later than 2009, maybe 2010. So we're in the, you know, at least the seventh year of the recovery from the Great Recession. Is there an historical track record as to how long recoveries can go on before we go back to another recession or depression?
Well, there's the sometimes there's the argument of the biblical seven lean years following seven fat years. I don't think there's anything mystical about that. And the time of recoveries have varied as the time of panics or depressions have. But the thing is, and you rightly point to the fact that the economy, not for everyone certainly, but as a whole, has been expanding and doing well going back 7 years or so now. Trump and the Republicans paint this picture of everything was horrible before we came in. In fact, the growth of the economy and the jobs added during Obama's last year were slightly better than they've been so far under Trump. But he's painted this picture of he's done all this stuff. It's simply a continuation of that. But this is one of the reasons why a tax cut, a huge tax cut, which will create a huge addition to the federal debt, is just so insane. We are at what economists consider full employment now. The economy is doing very well. The only time that adding to the deficit enormously makes any sense economically is if you need to stimulate the economy. You don't need to stimulate it now. And here's something that get their information from their friends or the Russians or whoever on Facebook and from Fox News would not be aware of, but I think even a lot of other people aren't aware of. If you look at when The additions to the federal debt, when the really big increases in deficits occurred, the only time they've occurred under Democratic administrations going back since World War I were during national emergencies, during the Depression itself under Roosevelt and the New Deal, then a huge surge in debt for the national emergency of World War II, and then Obama coming in after the collapse of 2008, a big increase in debt then. But if you look at the other times there's been a big increase in debt, it's under Republicans when, for the most part, there was no crisis. Under Reagan in particular, and the economy did need some stimulus then, there was at least a little bit of an excuse for that then. Then under George W. Bush, when actually following the policies the Republicans always say will lead to disaster, the Clinton budget of 1993 increased the top marginal rate on income taxes from 36 to 39.6%. Every Republican voted against it. Every free market economist said it would lead to disaster. Instead, it was followed, and not just because of the tax policy, but it certainly was a contributor to it, by one of the greatest periods of prosperity in American history, and amazingly, by a budget surplus in the last 2 years of the Clinton administration. Well, George W. Bush came in, and as a believer in the trickle-down economics idea, pushed through tax cuts again, and we wound up going back to big deficits and ultimately with the collapse of the economy.
I remember in 1993, Rush Limbaugh was on his radio show warning over and over again what a disaster this tax increase would be for the U.S. economy. And I still have that tape somewhere in my collection. But I want conservatives, though, would point to President Kennedy, who lowered taxes and made that famous statement, a rising tide lifts all boats, and say that when Kennedy reduced taxes, that did result in a turnaround of the economy.
That's the only thing they can point to, and it's a vastly different circumstance. For one thing, there was not the huge debt already that the country had, but those tax cuts were aimed much more at what they claim they're aiming at now, the middle class, not so heavily favoring the people at the top. And pointing to that as an example of trickle-down economics. And incidentally, trickle-down economics, again, has never worked, and yet these people, the top people in the Trump administration, economic advisors, have openly said, yes, I believe in trickle-down economics. Well, it simply doesn't work. People at the top getting more money does not mean that consumption is going to keep up with production. Somebody who is taking in enough money to be able to buy 300 automobiles a year isn't going to do that. He might buy five or six if he really likes to collect cars, but he's just not going to do it. And so to make the economy work, Obama was attacked, I think it was during the campaign, for saying you need to spread the money around a little, but indeed you do, not just as a question of morality, but as a question of economics, of making the economy work. And so the Kennedy tax cut, which also was then followed by all the social programs under Johnson that the Republicans have been against, and I think it's very important to realize, in addition to the horrors that are in this tax cut, it's been made very clear by the Republicans that they plan to follow this by saying, oh, now we have this bigger debt and we can't afford to have social programs, and they're going to start trying to cut back on Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid and so forth. And that is really the objective. As I said before, it's not the Trump tax cut. It should be called the Paul Ryan tax cut. And Paul Ryan, for some reason, since he was a teenager, has had the ideal of destroying all social programs and letting people fend for themselves. He claims to be a good Catholic, but I think when he looked at the Bible and read the Sermon on the Mount, he must have been reading it in a mirror, because he wants to do exactly the opposite of what Jesus said.
You know, I once had a teacher, I went to Catholic high school, and he was talking about Ayn Rand. I mean, Paul Ryan worships Ayn Rand.
Exactly.
And my one of my teachers said, you know, there is an inherent disagreement between Ayn Rand and the Catholic philosophy.
Yeah, well, for one thing, she was an atheist, but beyond that, just the whole idea of what she was preaching is diametrically opposed to the teachings of Jesus.
Robert, one last question. You're teaching there at Millsaps College in Mississippi. What are you hearing from students about the ending of the deductibility for student loan payments? How hard is that going to hit the students that you know there in Mississippi?
I don't think they're even aware of it. I mean, I've brought it up with a few students, and I think that, you know, the Republicans are trying to get this through so quickly because they don't want people to see what's in it. And you're not going to rile up middle class people on much that's going to go further than what finding out that the interest on student loans is not going to be deductible. Once that gets out, I mean, the plan is already opposed by a 2-to-1 margin, roughly. It'll get to be even more so. I mean, it's ridiculous. And you know, they're saying it's a middle-class tax cut, and yet they are putting in things and retaining things for private jets and interest paid and maintenance on private jets. And yet you can't deduct medical expenses. If you have very large medical expenses, you're not going to be able to deduct interest on student loans. And then they are also going to consider tuition waivers to be income, which will largely destroy graduate education in the STEM fields in the country. It's a total disaster. And once the public realizes this, even if they get it through, they're going to see people turn against the Republicans who put it through even more than they already are.
Well, the op-ed is called, "I'm a Depression Historian. The GOP tax bill is straight out of 1929. The author, Robert McElvain, has been our guest for the last half hour. He's the author of the book, The Great Depression, America, 1929 to 1941. And Robert, you're coming out with a new book soon?
Well, I have a few in the works. I have one on 1964, and then I've been working on a novel. The 1964 book is almost finished, going into that. I call it The Times They Were, A Change in 1964, the year the quote-unquote 60s began.
Well, Robert, thank you so much, and I hope that we can get you back soon, and I hope we don't enter another Great Depression.
Well, I'll agree with you on that for sure.
Robert, thanks.
Nice talking with you.
All right.
Bye.
Good to talk to you. Bye-bye. That's Robert McElvain. McElvain is spelled M-C-E-L-V-A-I-N-E, teaches at Millsaps College in Mississippi. Well, you're listening to WMNF in Tampa. Our phone number is 813-239-9663. We're going to open up the phone lines in just a moment. The PolitiFact website, which is a project that was started by the Tampa Bay Times, has announced its Lie of the Year for 2017. And earlier I spoke with Katie Saunders, who is the deputy editor of PolitiFact, and I asked her about PolitiFact's Lie of the Year. Katie Saunders, welcome to WMNF. Good to have you here.
Thank you for having us on.
What did PolitiFact determine was the Lie of the Year?
This year, we determined the Lie of the Year was Donald Trump's statement that the whole Russia thing is made up. It's a hoax by the Democrats to try to delegitimize his election.
And the Russia thing meaning?
Right. This is referring to Russian interference in the 2016 election.
Mm-hmm. Now, are we talking about the Russian government?
You know, we're talking about a concerted effort by agents in Russia to disrupt the political process. This has been something that's investigated by, is currently under investigation by the House and the Senate, as well as Special Counsel Robert Mueller. And there's been already a lot of evidence turned up that points to interference on the social media platforms that Americans use and a lot of propaganda against Hillary Clinton in particular in Donald Trump's favor.
Now, a lot of Democrats think that the Russian involvement in the election may have turned the tide in the election. Did you make a determination about that?
No, we didn't. We actually said we're not sure, or it doesn't look that way. But certainly there was an effort to boost Donald Trump's candidacy. And he has always been kind of sensitive about this topic. And by dismissing it, however, as something that is a hoax, or even appearing to take Vladimir Putin's word for it, that you know, over his intelligence agencies, as he has done, not all the time, but sometimes, it really doesn't help us get any closer to solving this problem in advance of the next election cycle.
So how does PolitiFact decide who the nominees are for the possible lie of the year?
Well, every year we come up with a ballot, and this is usually around 10 statements. And we look through our files for all of the statements that were false or pants on fire. And we're trying to find one that really resonated, it didn't just have a moment, but it really spoke to a trend across the whole year. I'll give you some examples so you know what else we're looking for. In 2016, we named fake news our lie of the year because you just saw the explosion of misinformation on social media. And in 2014, it was statements about Ebola and all of the hype that has come with that and scare that you had seen in the media. We've given it to Sarah Palin and President Barack Obama, and we've actually given it to Donald Trump once before in 2015.
What was the one for Donald Trump in 2015?
Well, it actually wasn't one. It was for three statements that were just out-and-out lies, and we couldn't pick one over the other. So we gave it to a few of his statements from the 2015 Republican primary, including that Muslims were celebrating 9/11 in the United States.
So did you consider maybe misstatements by Democrats or by liberals as possible nominees this year?
Yes, definitely. There were some memorable ones earlier in the year. We had Representative Maxine Waters, who said that she had never called for Trump's impeachment, when in fact there was video of her doing just that not much longer before she made her statement. We also considered a statement by John Lewis. He said that Trump's inauguration was the first one that he had ever skipped, and that was sad to him. But actually, he had skipped George W. Bush's first inauguration as well. So there were a few incredulous statements from Democrats that we considered. But I think when you have a president like Donald Trump, you have a lot of options and a lot of options of particular consequence that were driving the news cycle and really had more of a reverberation across the country and especially in the American consciousness.
Katie, any idea how many fact checks you make of people in Washington, D.C., including the president and members of Congress? Any idea how many times a year PolitiFact issues a fact check about somebody making a statement in Washington?
Oh, all the time, every day. It's not always President Trump. It's often House Speaker Paul Ryan, or just yesterday we posted another mostly false for Nancy Pelosi about wage growth under the Republicans. So we put out at least one or two a day, and I can tell you that last time we looked, we were approaching 15,000 fact checks since our founding in 2007. So you could try to divide that by 10, 10 years that we've been in existence to get a rough idea. But really, we have a bigger staff, and we have a lot of partners across this country who do what we do. So it's a lot.
And I guess where I was aiming with that question was, is there any way to tell in the first year of the Trump administration, if you were to compare it to the first year in the Obama administration, whether or not more lies came out of the Trump administration or the Obama administration, or have you not done that research yet?
That's interesting. We haven't made that particular comparison, but I can tell you that Donald Trump's record of statements that are rated pants on fire or false isn't just larger than the percentage of statements that we checked out from President Obama. It's larger. The larger percentage of wrong statements for any person, any figure that we have fact-checked. So while we haven't crunched the numbers, I would expect that Donald Trump's record in his first year is there will be a lot more false statements that we had checked out.
There's a sidebar to the PolitiFact Lie of the Year story in the Tampa Bay Times, and it says false claims rampant among Trump's team, to that point that you just made. Could you give us an example of not President Trump, but maybe statements, one statement by another member of President Trump's team that turned out to be false or pants on fire?
Absolutely. I think there was a trickle-down effect against the truth in the White House this year, and you had his top lieutenants and advisors really doubling down on his exaggerations and in some cases taking it even farther. So this happened on the day after the inauguration with Sean Spicer, his former press secretary, who said that was the largest audience to witness an inauguration, period. We rated that memorable claim pants on fire. And it really tended to kind of set the tone for the administration's tactics for the rest of the year. And I would add that we also have a readers poll where about 5,000 readers weighed in on what they thought should be lie of the year. And they agreed with us, more than half of them agreed with us, that it was the Russia misstatement but Sean Spicer's statement came in at number three. We had some other statements from Steve Mnuchin and Sarah Huckabee Sanders.
And what did they say?
So Steve Mnuchin, this goes back to tax returns. We've rated Trump's promise to release his tax returns promise broken, and Steve Mnuchin kind of was trying to explain why he wasn't going to do it. He said President Trump has given more financial disclosure than anybody else. That's only true, and it's not true. We rated it false. But what he's getting at is that his financial disclosure, which is required of all candidates, happens to be longer than all the other candidates because of his wealth, right? So he's released it. He's released a longer financial disclosure report than other presidential candidates. So that's a really silly point because Barack Obama, George W. Bush, Bill Clinton, they released substantial amount of tax returns every year in office, basically. And Donald Trump has indicated that's not going to happen, despite what he said on the campaign trail about waiting for an audit.
Mm-hmm. Have you heard from the White House? Has the White House answered back, knowing that President Trump's claims about Russia have been selected as the lie of the year?
We have not heard from the White House, as far as I know. We did present them with a trophy of sorts, and we said if they want the trophy, we can go give them the Lie of the Year Award trophy. But they have not expressed any interest in claiming that. And we continue to fact-check Donald Trump's statements, and I don't think it's come up. I think they're just going to ignore this one in the way that they did in 2015. But I could be wrong. It's only been a day.
All right. Well, Katie Sanders of PolitiFact, thank you so much for coming on WMNF.
Thank you for having me.
That's Katie Sanders, the deputy editor of PolitiFact, talking about the lie of the year that was just announced yesterday. The PolitiFact lie of the year is the claim by President Trump that Russia was not involved in the elections. Our phone number is 813-239-9663. Email address dj@wmnf.org. Well, in Alabama last night, Democrat Doug Jones surprised many people by beating Roy Moore, the Republican, in a special election for the U.S. Senate.
Thank you!
Bucking the odds and decades of Alabama political history, Democrat Doug Jones upset Republican Roy Moore in the state's special U.S. Senate election. The Jones victory culminated a tumultuous campaign marked by allegations of sexual impropriety by Moore, the former Alabama Supreme Court Chief Justice.
We have shown the country the way that we can be unified.
The Jones win shaves the Republican majority in the U.S. Senate to 51-49. On Twitter, President Trump congratulated Jones on a hard-fought win. I'm Mike Rossia.
Now, the Moore campaign has indicated that it will try to have a recount. Here's Bill Armistead, who's the chairman of the Moore campaign for Senate.
The Republican tech.
And this is Armistead from last night.
And you know, there's a law in Alabama that requires a recount if the vote is in within 0.5%, and that includes all the candidates that are on the ballot and any write-ins that are qualified to be a candidate. So at this point, we do not have a final decision on the outcome tonight. And we know that God is still in control, and we're going to give him the credit for how this turns out, because he has been with us every step of the way, and we continue to honor him in this campaign. Because you see, the vote has to be certified later this month, and then after the vote is certified, if it's within 0.5%, the law requires there to be a recount. You know, the military ballots aren't even in yet. They're not been counted. So.
All right, that's Bill Armistead, who's the campaign chairman of the Judge Roy Moore campaign for U.S. Senate yesterday in Alabama. He's the Republican. And it looks like they're going to ask for a recount. The rules in Alabama say that if you're within 0.5%, there's got to be an automatic recount, at least according to the what the results are right now. Jones beat Moore yesterday by 1.5%. Let's take some phone calls. We can talk about any of these topics, the Senate race in Alabama and the outcome. We can talk about the Great Depression and the causes of the Great Depression, and whether or not the Senate Republicans and House Republicans are making the same mistake that Calvin Coolidge did in the 1920s, and we can talk about PolitiFact, the lie of the year. 813-239-9663. Let's go to Mike, who's in Tampa. Hi, Mike. What's on your mind today?
Yes, compliments on your radioactivity show and the excellent guest you had today speaking about how bad the tax bill is. I completely agree with your point. It's one that I say the Republicans like to call it the death tax, but the person dying is not paying the taxes. It's people who are inheriting money. Now, I think people should be able to inherit money, but they should also pay a reasonable tax on it. And the estate tax has been liberalized quite a bit in the last, 15 years or so. And as you know, currently the first several millions of an estate are not taxed.
That's right. That's right.
Above that, that is taxed.
That's right. If you're a couple and you're inheriting, you can inherit the first $11 million with paying no taxes. And then everything.
When my mother.
Yeah, go ahead.
When my mother passed away in 1998, the limit was around $700,000. Below that was not taxable. We didn't cross that threshold, but we looked at it. It's been liberalized tremendously by Republicans over the years. Elimination of the estate tax, I don't know if that's what's in the current, conference between the Senate and the House, is completely irresponsible. I had no idea it would contribute to the debt as much as your guest said, but it's totally absurd.
All right, Mike, thanks a lot. Thanks for your comments.
Yeah, one secondary point. When John Kennedy and the Democratic Congress reduced taxes in the 60s, they reduced the top tax rate down to 70%.
That's right.
And if you saw the paper today, the Republicans want to reduce it from 39.6 down to 37. Thank you very much.
All right, Mike, thanks a lot. 813-239-9663. Ron in West Tampa writes to your guest about taxes, why is it that so many low and middle income people seem to buy into Trump's lies as well as this proposed tax bill? When it will affect them and me negatively? That's Ron in West Tampa. Maybe you've got an answer to that question. Our phone number, 813-239-9663. The interesting thing is that the polls show very little support across the board for the Republican tax plan in Washington, D.C. Let's take some more phone calls. 813-239-9663 is Angela's in Lakeland. Hi, Angela. What's on your mind?
Rob, good morning. Regarding the estate tax issue, I'm a paralegal. I worked for attorneys all my life, and I used to work for the head of the estate planning division of the American Bar Association. And he had some very, very powerful, rich clients. I won't name any. In particular, the Coca-Cola heiress, one of the primary Coca-Cola heiresses. Twice a year, him and she would send the plane for him, and he would go meet with her, and he would take his tax consultant with his insurance consultant. Rich people don't actually ever pay these taxes, and that's the myth that I haven't heard anybody discuss. They buy humongous life insurance policies, hundreds of billions of dollars of life insurance policies, and they pay, $200,000-$300,000 premium, and then when they die, the life insurance policy pays the taxes.
Yeah, and in addition to life insurance, there's a lot of other ways that people avoid paying estate taxes.
They can set up a trust,
right?
Right. Yeah.
So there are and a rich person is likely to have a great accountant. So it's interesting that so many, as that Ron in West Tampa said, so many people have sympathy for these millionaires and billionaires and want to give them more money, but at the same time they're stuck making $7 or $8 an hour. And why is that sympathy so strong sometimes among some Republicans at the low end of the income scale?
I think it's because they don't publicize the fact that if you don't have more than $10 million when you die, you pay nothing. It's only if you have $10 million or more than you pay. And that little fact isn't advertised a whole lot.
Yeah, that's really true. Angela, thanks a lot.
Thanks
for your phone call. 813-239-9663. Larry's in Sarasota. Larry, thank you for calling in. What would you like to say?
Well, I wanted to talk about the election in Alabama.
Okay.
I'm not sure if my numbers are 100% correct, Rob, but I looked at the available voters in Alabama. It was over 3 million. And after the election count, it was only about 1.3 million. And when we talk about Russians getting involved in our election, how about Americans getting involved in our election? I think those numbers are probably about the same for the national elections. And what is it with Americans that just don't want to vote? They're too lazy.
Why do you think? I mean, that's true not just in special elections like yesterday's in Alabama, but even when you get into a general election involving the presidency, a huge number of people who are eligible.
They don't take enough civics classes in school. They don't get it. They don't understand how incredible lucky we are to be in this great country, but it's disgusting. It's terrible. I started voting when I was 18 years old.
How old are you now?
56. I've never missed it. I've never missed an election.
Yeah, I've never, since I became 18, I've never missed an election.
Yeah, I mean, it's a civic duty. It's a civic duty. I'm disgusted with that. When I see the amount of Republicans are out there and the amount of independents, the amount of Democrats, and less than one-third shows up, pathetic.
It is. It is. But it could be that people feel like they don't like the candidates. It could be that they feel like Congress and the legislature have never done anything for them, so they sit out elections.
Well, in that situation, Rob, let's realize that there's never a perfect candidate. You need to pick one. And you can vote across party lines if you like, you know, so I,
yeah. Well,
I don't know much about either one of those candidates, but I can't imagine people not getting involved. I'm just disgusted with it.
All right.
It's terrible.
Larry, thanks a lot. Yeah. Thanks. I'm sure a lot of people feel the same way. 813-239-9663. Tony writes this. He's in St. Pete. He says, your guest about taxes is right about the estate tax. The Republicans so cleverly have relabeled it the death tax. U.S. already has the largest wealth divide in the developed world between the top 1% and the rest of us. It doesn't take advanced mathematics to predict that we will have a hereditary aristocracy of wealth that many of our ancestors left Europe to escape. Ironically, virtually all European countries are now far more egalitarian than we are. Social mobility numbers in the U.S. are down compared to most parts of Europe. Gina writes this, it's a horrible tax bill, only favoring the very wealthy, but making extremely profound changes, such as higher taxes for employees versus independent contractors. The question is, what can we do to stop it? What do you recommend, writes Gina? If you oppose a bill, you might want to get in touch with your members of Congress. 813-239-9663. Let's go to Mike, who's in North Carolina. Hi, Mike. You're on M&F. What would you like to say?
Hey, Rob. Before I moved to the footprint of WM&F back in 1981, I spent the first 30 years of my life born, bred, schooled in Alabama, and while the football team might have made me proud, I don't think I've ever been so proud politically of the state of Alabama. And going back all the way to the embarrassment of George Wallace throwing himself at the University of Alabama to stop integration, we've had a checkered past, no doubt. But when you get 40% turnout in an election that was predicted to only turn out about 18 to 20%, and you see the Democratic coalition that can work, and that is people of color and women primarily, it makes me hope that Jones runs for president.
Wow. Mike, so have you been watching TV the last week or so with the interviews with people in Alabama?
Oh, my God, yes. And, you know, I have inside contacts, too. My sister runs a large progressive organization, AIDS Alabama, and for the people, gay people especially, Roy Moore was their worst possible nightmare. And on the other side of my personal coin, I have my beloved mother at 85 that's Fox indoctrinated, as well as her church. And, you know, I hear what they are brainwashing her with, and it makes me sad. But, yes, I mean, there's a lot of proud people in Bama today. And I think this is the first domino in the cracking of the Trump regime.
All right. Well, let's see if that happens. Mike, thanks a lot.
All right.
Great to hear from you. 813-239-9663. And let's go to Sam, who's in Seminole. Hi, Sam. You're on WM&F. What would you like to say?
Yeah. Hi, Rob. Hey, Rob, I just wanted to say that the one caller says something about why doesn't people vote?
Right.
And I think that it might not be such an issue with the local and state elections, but this past election with the electoral vote, I think in some ways that has disenfranchised some people. And also with President Trump continually calling legitimate news fake news, people don't really know what to believe about candidates anymore, so they just probably throw up their hands and say, I'm just not going to vote at all. I vote every year, And I'm going to continue to vote every year because people have died in wars and other things so that I can vote.
People have died in people have died in movements, yeah.
Yes, sir, exactly. So that's just kind of my take on it. Hey, Rob, have you ever had a show about the Electoral College?
We did several back in the day, but we haven't done one recently, so you're right, we're about due. I know for a while, I don't think he advocates it anymore, but Senator Bill Nelson was urging changes to the Electoral College system, and there is a group out there that wants to have just a direct vote and to do away with the Electoral College. So we'll do another one of those shows.
Okay, well, thank you, and I love the show. I appreciate you, and have a good day.
All right, Sam, thanks a lot. Thank you. And let's go to John in Port Richey. Hi, John. You're on WMNF.
Hey, thanks for the show, Rob. Quick thing. I was listening to an interview with the governor of Tennessee, I think, and he was talking about the state tax, income tax write-off that they're getting rid of.
Mm-hmm.
He was saying that that basically is a subsidy to those states. So I was wondering, if the write-off to those states is a subsidy to those people in those states, then isn't the tax break for the rich a subsidy to them, a tax break on the estate tax? Isn't that a subsidy to their heirs? And isn't the tax break on corporations a subsidy to those corporations then?
Well, yeah, I would think you could make that argument, but your first what you're quoting the governor of Tennessee on is not true, and our guest in the first half hour of the show was pointing out that those states that don't have an income tax tend to be the states that
that's not what he was saying.
Well, no, just stick with me because I'm on point. The states like New York and California going to lose out on this. They are net donors to the federal government. And the other states that don't have those kind of high taxes that New York and California do and Massachusetts do, they are subsidizing states like Mississippi and Alabama.
Okay,
so,
I agree with that.
So the governor of Tennessee was not being accurate.
That's true that he might not be accurate, but he made that statement that the tax break itself is a subsidy. That's what I'm kind of getting at, not whether or not they give more back to the federal government than what they get, whether or not that statement is true or not. But just that idea that he was floating that.
Well, you can't have it doesn't exist in a vacuum. It is a subsidy to those people in that state. Here in Florida, if you itemize your deduction, your sales tax is deductible.
Yeah.
So that you might make the argument that it's a subsidy to the people of Florida.
Right.
But in the end, you got to look at the big picture, I think. And the big picture is that states that don't have that deduction on their taxes, on their federal income tax, are really subsidized in a big way by
the federal
government.
They get more money back from the federal government. Yeah, I agree with that. But I'm just wondering if that concept is true, then isn't all these other tax breaks the subsidies to those rich people?
Well, I think that part of your statement is true. I think that part. But no, the first part I disagreed with when you were quoting the governor of Tennessee.
Well, I'm just quoting what he said.
I know. I know. Yeah. That's what I was disagreeing with.
Okay, thanks, Bob.
All right, John. Thanks a lot. There are so many emails here. I feel like I should read at least one of them because so many people have taken time to write. And you are listening to WMNF in Tampa. Let's see if I can read the most recent email. Ernie writes this one. He says, the reason for the estate tax is to help prevent forming a perpetual aristocracy here in the U.S. That's Ernie in Port Richey. And let's go back to the phones for a few more minutes. We're going to go to Shane, who's in Riverview. Hi, Shane. You're on MNF. What would you like to say?
Hey, I decided to pick up the phone just now because of two callers ahead of me called and said Doug Jones should run for president. And I can tell you something. That's exactly what I said last night while he was giving his victory speech. When he came up on that stage and he says, I'm so freaking overwhelmed, I don't know what to say. It just brings me right back to 2008 with Obama. And I'm telling you right now, the Democratic Party, I think, is getting back to where it needs to be. And Doug Jones should really, especially if he could get in and get a vote against this tax plan, he would definitely be up there for me for one of the candidates to run for president on the Democratic side.
Well, that's very interesting. All right, Shane. Thanks a lot. Thanks for your phone call.
All right.
All right. So maybe Doug Jones or one of his relatives is listening. Let's go to Mary in Tampa. Hi, Mary. We have about 30 seconds.
Trump has been awarded the lie of the year, and they have a trophy to give to him. I hope that trophy is huge.
I want to see that trophy
that's ever been given to anyone ever. He earned it, and he deserves it.
You know, Katie's going to be on my TV show this week, so I'm going to send her an email and ask her if she can bring in the trophy.
That would be
show
awesome.
It on TV. All right, Mary, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Rob.
Thanks. Great to hear from you. Well, if you want to comment about today's show, please call us up at 813-238-8001 and record your comment on extension 115. And we'll play your comments back tomorrow morning at 11 o'clock. Stay tuned because coming up next, Nola will be here with the Midpoint program. Sean wants us to know that there is a story on our website about the Electoral College. Go to WMNF.org and look it up, and you'll be able to find it. Stick around for the news, and then Midpoint right here on WMNF Tampa 88.5 FM.